Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Today we're going to focus on those who commit the highest volume and least investigated crime, fraud. In the last year, one in 16 adults in England and Wales were victims of fraud. I'm joined by my co-presenter Rob Allen and by two experts. Dr. Nicola Harding runs the organisation We Fight Fraud, and Michael Levy is Professor of Criminology at Cardiff University. Rob, have you been scammed or defrauded ever? What happened?
Well, it sometimes seems like people are trying to do it most weeks, but I think it's only really happened once when I was on holiday and suddenly money started disappearing from a bank account. Fortunately, I noticed it, rang the bank, stopped the card, got the money back. No idea if any action was taken against the person. They seemed to think it might have been a waitress in a restaurant who'd taken the card behind the back and cloned it. But as I say, fortunately, that's the only example in recent times.
Card cloning is incredibly common. And I very much doubt if they did anything in particular in terms of investigating it, given that it was abroad. Nicola, have you been defrauded? And what happened if you were?
I've not been defrauded, but given the work in fraud prevention now, we're constantly approached and attacked. So we just get all kinds of different, you know, phishing emails.
Can you explain what a phishing email is?
So a phishing email is where someone will send you an email and it can really look like a legitimate email from Microsoft, from a retailer, from your friend. And usually there's a call to action in it, like, click this link, please. What they're trying to do is essentially get you to open the link, submit your personal data, and then they'll use that to defraud you. So it's kind of phishing for your details.
I'm slightly freaked out that they're doing that to a charity called We Fight Fraud.
Well, I think because of the nature of who we are, so the business itself is former criminals. So my business partner, Tony Sales, it was once known as Britain's greatest fraudster by the press, but he's worked for the last nearly 15 years now in fraud prevention, I guess trying to make amends for what he's did, but also use his expertise to stop it. That is a very attractive challenge to criminals out there to try and get one over on the people who are trying to prevent what they're doing. So, and, you know, just in our personal lives, you know, I've got five children and I'm constantly getting messages saying, "Mum, I've lost my phone. I need you to transfer me money or whatever." And I know it's not any of my kids because they're sat in the other room, you know, and it's those tactics that we're all seeing all the time, whether we realise it or not. If you own a mobile phone, you've got an email account, then you've definitely had a fraudulent attack. That's just where we're at.
So, Nicola, I have been the victim of a phishing fraud. In this case, somebody pretended to be from my bank and persuaded me to transfer quite significant amounts of money. Thankfully, the bank had barriers to that money going through. So I've been a victim, but I still think my archetype of a fraud victim is someone vulnerable, maybe a bit stupid. Is there any truth in that?
No, not at all. We're all potential victims of fraud nowadays. There is so many different attack vectors that fraudsters will use that it's impossible to be across all of them. And I miss them out, and this is my job. Tony always does a really good analogy, and he says that none of you would be upset if you didn't score a penalty against a Premiership goalkeeper. That's their job. They're supposed to keep the balls out the net. This is organised criminals' job. They're experts at it. We don't know because we're living life and assuming that people have the same moral standard, the same intentions as what we do. So we're going through life thinking that we can give a certain level of trust to people and we should be able to do that. Unfortunately, fraudsters will use this and prey upon it and prey upon systems that already exist. You know, the fact that you may expect a phone call from your bank if something goes wrong. You know, they'll use already established systems and processes and manipulate them for their own gain. So I think to think that a fraud victim is someone who's particularly vulnerable, we're all vulnerable. Over 40% of all documented crime now is fraud in the UK. There's a huge dark figure of fraud that just doesn't get reported because maybe it was only a small amount, or maybe it was done by a neighbour or someone that you knew and you don't want to get them in trouble, or maybe you've been defrauded and you don't even realise it yet. So it's not just, you know, the little old lady who let in a guy with a fake gas man lanyard, which is maybe what I might have thought a fraudster looked like when I was younger. Whereas now, fraud's just got so sophisticated, and becoming a victim of fraud has such a stigma attached to it when it absolutely should not. Fraud victims aren't stupid. They shouldn't have seen it coming. Why should they? They were up against serious organised criminals. It's like playing a game of chess when you don't know the rules.
Yeah, and I agree. And by the way, I did report it to Action Fraud, obviously, and I got no response from them whatsoever. This is the government agency supposed to deal with it. Michael, the association of fraud with white-collar crime, so as in done by middle-class people, is that cliche, does it have any truth to it?
Well, I think what we have to do is to move away from the assumption that fraud is committed by any one type of person. As Nicola was saying, fraud can happen to a very wide distribution of people. It's been democratized in victims, but it's also been democratized by offenders. So it never was the exclusive preserve of middle-class people, but the technologies of and the different vectors of attack are so wide now that most organized crime types of people can do it. There's crime as a service technologies to help you on your way, almost handbooks to teach you how to defraud, which you can just buy quite cheaply, and you just follow these quite simple rules. And if you fail, well, the downside risk is quite modest. Yeah, the chance of anybody doing something about it, as in your own case, Penelope, are very low. Yeah, so you've lost a little bit of investment and time. But they are still done by both middle class and upper class people. You know, Sam Bankman-Fried, the most high profile recent example, who did FTX cryptocurrency investment scam for billions, was the son of two Stanford University law professors and still apparently found difficulty in accepting that what he was doing was actually criminal. Yeah, so we've got elite people doing it, young Silicon Valley types, middle management people, clerks in finance doing it. So we need to stop thinking that it's only phishing scams or it's only WhatsApp scams. These tend to preoccupy us a lot, but it's also posh people. But the level of attempted scams that many of us are subjected to on a daily basis is quite high. So I'd more or less agree, but not entirely with Nicola, that why would you expect them to? We should expect them to, but we might not expect them to in the very type of scam that we're exposed to. And that's why particularly the more trusting of us, who tend to be the vulnerable in the stereotypical sense, older people, people who are more trusting. But, you know, the data from CIFAS and others show that it's actually younger people who are more commonly the victims than older people are. But that's probably because they get a lot more attempts because they're online more and they're exposed to it. Doesn't mean to say they're all traumatized, but you know, we have to see fraud as an adjunct to life. And really almost none of us is truly safe. It depends on the context and whether our suspicions are aroused and how suspicious we are. Nicola and I, we're very suspicious. But my wallet got nicked in Brussels railway station on my way to the Eurostar. And within 15 minutes, somebody was trying to use one of my cards in a corner shop round the corner. So I knew it was gone when Barclays phoned me, giving away a crucial bit of information there. You know, was this my transaction? No, thank you very much. Cancelled. Problem solved. Yeah. Was it traumatic? No. But then I hadn't really trusted anybody as an individual.
Mm. I mean, I think there was a survey, the CIFAS survey you mentioned, that found that 1 in 8 people admitted themselves to having committed a fraud. I mean, Nicola, can we sort of bottom out exactly what we're talking about? What are the kind of commonest ones? Is it mostly kind of phishing and cloning?
Those who are convicted of fraud are generally convicted by the government of fraud against the government, things like benefit fraud, for example. And they're a very different demographic, again, who aren't the types of people who are engaging in, you know, sending out speculative text messages or what have you. It's usually out of kind of desperation or circumstance, and they've, you know, not informed the benefit office of changes or things like that. So if we think about who and what a fraudster is in the popular imagination, there's the shady organised crime figure that we consider, and there's the benefit cheat. The ones we don't really consider are white-collar criminals, although that's the basis of theoretical work, you know, historically in criminology, thinking about people having the opportunity to commit fraud at work.
I know that you were yourself convicted of benefit fraud. How did you get involved in that?
It was a crime, really, of omission. I was in an abusive marriage at the time, which was subject to coercive control and economic abuse. And I basically had no access to my own finances, but my now ex-husband was in and out of my life like a yo-yo. And every time he went in and out and I informed the tax office that I'd had a change in circumstances, it took them 12 weeks to deal with. And it would leave me in severe financial hardship with very young children. And I was just at the end of my tether, to the point where I just stopped telling them because I couldn't deal with the kind of ups and downs of life. So my crime was that I lived with my partner when I claimed that I was a single parent. At the time that I started that claim, I was a single parent. I just didn't tell the changes. And it's a very different system now, I will say. I'm talking 18 to 20 years ago for when the actual offence occurred, because it took them 4 years to take me to court. But I didn't act when I should have acted, and that's how I ended up in that position. But the impact on me and my family then was, it made it almost so that I couldn't leave, because I couldn't then access those systems. So I got a 9-month sentence suspended for 2 years. I went to Crown Court, because when you defraud tax credits, everything that you've ever received from them is then null and void. It's all considered fraudulent. So the benefits that I'd received for the previous 3 years amounted to 23,000. So they said I'd defrauded 23,000. But in that time, I would have had, you know, recourse to public funds in terms of financial support and help. So it looked like a high figure of money, but I hadn't like lived a lifestyle with that. I'd just been feeding my kids and paying my rent and stuff. I left my ex-husband in 2010. I was convicted in 2008. And coercive controlling legislation didn't come in until 2015. So none of everything I've just told you was ever considered during my court case. And ultimately, if we want to know why fraud happens, it comes back to major societal issues. There will always be greedy people who want more than the other, who will manipulate and whatnot. But the fraud epidemic isn't because all of a sudden everyone wants to get ahead and wants to be manipulative and wants to steal from others. It's because there's other major social ills going on in society, and crime and criminal justice is always the backstop to that. Crime figures should be a temperature gauge of exactly how sick society is. And when fraud goes up, that's a real problem.
Mm. In your case, Nicola, you were convicted. You didn't go to prison, but it sounds from what you say as though you might well have done. I mean, that seems quite a harsh penalty for the circumstances you describe, which could easily be seen as you, in a sense, as a victim as much as an offender. I mean, Michael, is one of the issues here that when the government, perhaps, or the council, if it's something to do with council tax, are the victims, perhaps people don't necessarily see that there's a huge amount of harm there. But nonetheless, the criminal justice system does seem to see that there's a lot of harm there and has quite harsh penalties. Is that a point, do you think?
Well, how harsh is harsh? I think one of the factors that influences the way the courts react, apart from the sentencing guidelines which have been developed by the Sentencing Council, is the perception that there's a lot of it about and we need to send a message. So it becomes part of the broader communications about harmfulness and wrongfulness.
But Michael, criminological evidence has said again and again and again that criminal sanctions are not a good deterrent to the crime.
Well, what it says generally is that being caught is more important
than in the actual sanction. And we're talking here about quite harsh sentences for fraud being meted out. So, I mean, do you think criminal sanctions, in particular harsher criminal sanctions, are, in the case of fraud, a deterrent when they might not be for other crimes?
Well, I don't think they are, because the probability of conviction is low. You know, even in benefit fraud, there is still quite a bit of discretion used not to prosecute people, get taken off benefits, for example, as a way of sanctioning them rather than prosecuting them. £23,000 for other types of crime would seem like a lot of money for an offence to be sentenced. Nicola has given us a good reason for why it wasn't actually £23,000 worth of fraud, but that was the offence of conviction. But people tend to think differently about fraud amounts compared to other amounts. So I don't think it is a big deterrent, but a lot of sanctions are there because the officialdom wants to send messages out to people that this behaviour is unacceptable and this is what you get. And that's why very often the media say, you know, the defendants in this case got X months of imprisonment. They use months because that makes it sound bigger.
Because it's not the message really to the criminals, right? It's the message to the broader public that we're doing something about crime. Crime is the biggest political hot potato going, you know. So it's about, we want to be showing that we are doing something and that we take this seriously. And if that sacrifices, you know, a single mum that has maybe circumstances that the papers are never going to write about, you know, it's just about the headline. And what's that headline going to achieve? Well, the police are up against it. But equally, they want to have wins because they need to show that what they're doing is effective and justified. We convicted X amount. We sent so many away. And then you go into POCA, like Proceeds of Crime Act, because they took me to POCA as well, which would have allowed them to do things like, had I owned a house, they could have seized the house and taken the money back in a lump sum. The judge at the time said, do not bring her back for POCA. We know she's got no money. But it was public policy at the time that every benefit fraud case went back to POCA. I had to go through fact-finding. They froze my bank accounts. If they hadn't have done POCA, I would have had to pay that money back and it would have been garnished.
So taken away from you via the tax system?
Yeah. So they would have just taken, you know, a tenner a week or whatever it was. But the judge awarded a nominal pound. So I had to pay a pound and I didn't have it taken back. So it actually shot the system. A POCA hearing costs the Crown Court about £15,000 every time they sit, which was said and stated in my case. He ordered a nominal pound. I left the Crown Court and tried to pay it in the Crown Court, but you can't pay fines in the Crown Court. So I had to go to a magistrate's court. And I carried that receipt with me for 6 years. And the reason why I did that was that after 28 days, they came to arrest me to say that I hadn't paid the pound. And that if they'd arrested me at that point, I would have been recalled to prison to serve the full 9 months of my suspended sentence. And that little receipt was the only thing that stopped me going back to prison. So regardless, the POCA proceedings there were to enforce further punishment and further stress. The only thing that I had was that I paid it the same day as the court hearing and I kept hold of the receipt. If I didn't have that receipt, I'd have gone and done 9 months in prison with a brand new baby.
But in a different kind of case, yeah, if we had a bunch of payment card fraudsters, cloners, or Tinder swindler type romance scammers, then the public might well say, what deterrence is there? And indeed, what reformation is likely to happen to people? So that's part of the root of retributivist punishment. Nicholas case is a common enough one in benefit fraud cases where a lot of it is failure to report change of circumstance. And you're right, a lot of that has changed. But for a lot of other things, which are really intentional crimes done by people who have the opportunity, we'd have to change social inequality, global inequality, in order to reduce the temptation for those people to commit offences. And it's very difficult to see how that global equality would happen. But we do need to think harder about what it is we're trying to achieve with criminal justice and what we could achieve with better prevention.
But Michael, isn't it true that at the top of the fraud tree in very, very serious cases, companies and sometimes individuals, if they pay the money back, can avoid prosecution altogether? I'm thinking of the serious fraud office is encouraged to kind of reach settlements, isn't it, in those cases. How does that fit in with the philosophy that you've just described?
Well, you can't send a company to jail. I mean, you could liquidate.
You can send the chairman or the chief executive.
And this is why there are proposals to reform the nature of attribution of criminality in serious fraud office cases. But deferred prosecution agreements are commonplace in serious fraud office cases with big companies. The options are limited. If we hit them very hard, they may go bust and people who work there won't have a job anymore. The issue about bringing individuals to criminal court is a very important one. But I have to say the British system has largely failed in those cases. But there aren't very many of them numerically compared to the people who are committing the kinds of frauds we started off talking about, the card cloning, the WhatsApp messaging. You know, very few elites are involved in those kinds of scams. They don't need to.
But is there any evidence that imprisonment is effective in terms of reducing crime fraud?
No, but it's very difficult to see what evidence we have that would enable us to draw that conclusion. Certainly, other measures might be more effective. If you're a lawyer and you get done, or if you're an accountant who gets done, then you will be almost certainly struck off and never allowed to practice again. But, of course, reducing reoffending is not the only reason for sentencing. It can be to express society's disapproval. So increasing sentencing at the criminal justice stage doesn't magically produce deterrence. But, say, foreign scammers, the courts might reasonably conclude that what else is there that we can do with people like that? And we need to show the public that something is being done.
I think as well, though, I mean, obviously you've got to catch them first, which the global nature of fraud and hiding behind, you know, spoof callers make that really, really difficult. But the biggest lesson that came from the guys that I know who have committed fraud that have gone through different programmes, there's always been an underlying social issue. So for Tony, he was groomed into organised crime as a very, very young child. But the biggest thing that they've all got in common is that some forms of restorative justice. So that in terms of thinking about actually viewing the harm that they've done.
Yeah, because presumably for many people who commit fraud, they don't understand, they don't think through that they may be doing harm to individuals when they do it.
Totally. Like the example that Tony gave me was he would be perpetrating a lot of identity fraud. So he said for him, it was just data. He never actually saw them as a person, because when he made, you know, a fake ID, it was always his face next to their name and their details. So he just wasn't thinking about what he was doing to other people. And he was in prison when he decided, I'm not doing this anymore. And there was a couple of different things that happened. One was he realised he was pushing the trauma that he'd experienced as a child onto his children. But the other was a police officer came down whilst he was in cell and said, I hope you're happy with yourself. And he went, what do you mean? And she said, I've got a girl crying upstairs because of you. And he went, don't know what you're talking about. I've never done anything to a woman. Because he's a man, he's never taken the identity of a woman. And she went, no, but you took a dead dad, didn't you? And slammed the door up. And he said it was like that moment of, what? There's people behind all of this. And it completely flip-changed his thinking. He then signed up to a critical thinking course in prison, motivated by that moment. And it made him think completely differently. He just knew a world that had always taken from him, so he was always going to take from it. But he has got a very soft heart underneath it, and he didn't ever want to hurt anyone else in the way that he'd been hurt. So that victim impact and the awareness of that, but also understanding what you've done. You know, we do major projects now around money mule activity.
What's a money mule, Nicola?
So a money mule is where you will have money transferred into your bank account from someone, and then you'll transfer it on to someone else and leave a little bit for yourself. And what that is doing is laundering criminal money. So when someone commits a fraud, they won't do it straight into a criminal account. They'll do it into a money mule account, and they'll try and send that money as many times as possible. Because if not, there's in the digital world of finance now, there's a paper trail. So money mules are absolutely critical to the working of fraud and financial crime. And in the last couple of years, definitely, particularly with COVID, has meant there's an explosion, cost of living crisis. You know, we did a research around illegal money lending in the UK and spoke to just under 300 people who were engaging with loan sharks. And I'd say about 95% of them had also, unknowingly most of the time, also been a money mule and siphoned either the proceeds of drug dealing or other criminal activity fraud through their account to be able to pay their debt. So people will be getting involved in it not knowing what they're doing, because how can you understand that the money you've just sent from there to there, couple of clicks on your online banking that earned you £50, £200, £300, whatever it was, that you could be funding terrorist activity, or that you've just moved the money that's been taken off someone who's had their life savings emptied out of a bank account? You're not going to put those things together. It's one of the kind of biggest social engineering tactics of fraud. You can't see end to end, and more people getting engaged with fraud or becoming money mules, or, you know, buying stolen goods in the pub because it helps you get by. The cost of living crisis has got us there.
Or overclaiming on insurance.
Yeah.
Or things like that. And very often, because a lot of people regard insurance companies and financial institutions as, if you like, what Al Capone called the legitimate racket, they feel that ripping them off is okay.
Perhaps that's a note on which we should draw things to a close, Michael and Nicola. It's been a fascinating conversation, and one that could go on for a lot longer than we've got time for, sadly. We like to finish these episodes by asking each of you in turn, if you were in charge of the system, Prime Minister, whatever, you could do one thing to improve the way in which we deal with this, prevent fraud, reduce it. What would that one thing be? Nicola, what would you do?
I think we need to take target hardening approaches. Target hardening is you make the victim, the target, more secure. And I think we've done that physically. We stopped, you know, got people to shut the windows to stop burglars getting in, put, you know, neighbourhood watch signs up, and that. They're all examples of physical target hardening that was to address burglary. I think we can take a target hardening approach by producing greater levels of awareness, greater understanding of what fraud and financial crime looks like, and really, really focusing on prevention, making it so that we're not just seeing, you know, the most popular romance fraud on Tinder swindler or whatever, but that actually we really understand the ways in which criminals are attacking and in ways that are easy to understand and easy to engage with. You know, unfortunately, this needs to be part of the national curriculum, for example.
Okay. And what about you, Michael?
I take a broadly similar view. I think one of the difficulties with target hardening is that there are so many changing ways of attacking. So, you know, you almost need to be permanently alert. And we need third parties to have an interest, you know, like, for example, banks and social media companies to play a more active role in cutting out opportunities to defraud us. This is starting to happen, but it needs to develop a lot more. And perhaps we need to prioritize who we care about the most for protection and develop different systems. I mean, there are true call type ways of enabling vulnerable people living on their own from getting calls from strangers. Frankly, they might welcome the social interaction at times because those may be the only calls they get. So reducing loneliness is very important. So we need to be more creative in positive alternatives, as well as trying to cut down on opportunities to defraud. But it's very hard to arm yourself successfully because there are so many ways in which you might be ripped off. Getting free of them all is very hard.
Indeed, indeed. And Rob, what about you? If you were Prime Minister, how would you reduce the number of people committing fraud?
I was taken with the possibility that Nicola mentioned about restorative justice and the idea of somehow trying to get through to people who commit this crime that there is a real person who suffers at the end of the day, and whether that is an area that could be expanded and tested to see whether it can reduce reoffending.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Rob, Nicola and Michael. And if you'd like to find out more about Nicola and Michael's work on fraud, do have a look at our programme notes. And if you like this podcast, do subscribe on whatever platform you use so you'll get a reminder of our next one. Thanks. Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very interesting.